Like so many other people waiting for news from the aftermath of the cyclone that hit Burma, Paimong has been dialing and dialing to try and get through to his relatives in the capital, Rangoon. His wife is also waiting for news of her family, and she was taking a turn with the phone when, almost miraculously, they got a connection.
It was a huge, huge relief. I felt like a huge burden has been lifted off my chest. And as soon as I could hear some of the words coming out from the other end, and I knew that everybody was safe. So I was very, very happy and very relieved.
Everyone at that home in Burma's capital had survived the cyclone, but unfortunately for Paimong, he still has no news of his family. And this is just one tiny attempt to get news from the scene of a humanitarian disaster that may involve millions of lives. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
It has been 5 days since Cyclone Nargis tore up the southern shore of Burma with fierce winds and a deadly ocean storm surge. However, the small Asian nation is fiercely controlled by a military leadership, so only now are the very first shipments of aid going into Burma, and only now are the very first news reports starting to come out.
Tens of thousands have died. Even more are still missing. As rescue teams get to areas presently cut off, those figures are likely to rise. Of those who survived, almost 1 million people are thought to be without food or shelter. All this in a region once called the rice basket of Burma.
All the power lines are down, which also affected a lot of the water supplies, and most mobiles are not working. No telephone lines are able to get into these areas that are affected.
Strangely enough, though, it was a telephone connection that brought the Mong family its first news of the disaster in their home country. Paimong and his wife, Nyunyu Mong, live in Anaheim, California, and almost all their family members are in the capital city, Rangoon. They found out about the cyclone almost by chance.
When I was browsing the internet, and when I saw the news, I couldn't believe my eyes because it was saying the death toll was more than 10,000, and a lot of villages were gone, and people died, and commodity prices have started climbing up.
Now, you still have family in Burma, is that right?
I have grandparents, I have aunts, I have uncles, I have friends, families.
Have you been able to find out any news about how they're doing?
Not at all. Ever since I heard the news, that was Saturday, I've been calling them every hour of the day and night, and so far our calls have not been able to go through.
Now, your wife also has family there as well, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. She still has her parents living in Rangoon. If I'm not mistaken, she had to die more than 800 times to be able to reach through to her family.
I was so worried. I knew that everything has cut down, and I knew that it's going to be taking long, but still I've been hoping. Even I get one time connection, trying and trying again.
Your husband, Pai, was telling me that you dialed something like 800 times?
Yes, even like I have been gone for the 2 phone calls, but I didn't give up. I really want to hear something, you know. My mom, is that be okay? I just want to hear what is happening, going on, and what's going on over there, you know.
She was able to get through to her parents last night. When I heard the phone click, like on the other end, somebody pick up, I heard a hello. I was like, it was a huge, huge relief. Felt like a huge burden has been lifted off my chest. And as soon as I could hear some of the words coming out from the other end, and I knew that everybody was safe. So I was very, very happy and very relieved.
And who picked up the phone? Tell me what happened.
Her grandma. I was standing right next to her when she was speaking to her grandmother.
And she's been a little bit shaky. I'm okay, honey. Please don't worry about me. I have nothing hurt. Don't worry.
And both of them were so relieved to hear each other's voice. And then she started asking, how about her parents, how about aunts, uncles, you know, all the names. She started throwing all these names.
I asked for my grandfather and all my aunties.
But the answer was yes, 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 they are safe. So that was a big relief taken off her. But then came the bad news. The windows were like banging against each other. And then the window pane started shattering. And the next thing they knew, they heard a loud noise. And then the roof got blown away.
The roof of that very house.
The entire roof. The house that her grandparents live in, the entire roof got blown away. And that loud noise that they heard, it was the roof.
And nobody was injured when that happened?
Fortunately, no.
And I told her, I asked her, like, where do you live right now? And she said, she's with my mom.
She is about 85 years old. And she told us that was the very first time in her life that she experienced such a horrible thing. The winds was like blowing so hard that she even thought, you know, at one time she could be blown away.
My grandma said, I didn't think that must be that strong. This is the worst thing ever, she said.
They told us that all the trees are blocking the roads. Big old trees like banyan trees have been uprooted, and they were just lying on the streets blocking the flow of the traffic. Most of the villages have been wiped out. One of the biggest cities in the whole entire city, there's only one survivor left.
Now, how would the grandmother know all this detail of what was happening in the Lower Delta?
Through the TV news broadcast by the government of Burma. It's been about 2-3 days since they were hit by the storm, so people have started moving about. So as people move from one region to another, they bring along these bad news.
What did your wife's grandmother say about the warning that people had concerning this cyclone?
They saw a very brief broadcast made by the government of Burma one day before the storm hit. They made it sound very casual. What they said was, even if the cyclone hit, the cyclone will come in with the wind force of 30 miles per hour, which is totally far off from the reality.
Yeah, I've been reading newspaper accounts that said the winds were up over 120 miles an hour.
120 at least. I would say like a category 3 or 4 hurricane.
I want you to help me understand a little bit about how news gets out in Burma, because as you know, it's a dictatorship. All the media is controlled by the government. But why would the government restrict information about a weather event like this? Why wouldn't they just tell the truth and tell people to save themselves?
I'm seeing two possibilities. One is total incompetence, and the other is viciousness. Very little money goes into other government services. So a disaster like this happened, the government is very ill-equipped to handle such a disaster, such a large scale. Being born and raised in Burma, I know how the military government of Burma operates. They are very vicious. Now, last September, if you recall, a lot of people took to the street to protest against the rising price of commodities. So they deliberately not warn the people so people die.
Ugh, that's pretty cold-hearted there, Pai.
Very inhumane, very cold-hearted. And if they did it on purpose, I wouldn't be surprised, because they have done it too many times to the people of Burma.
They're not going to be okay. There's no good water over there. So I'm pretty much sure, like, people are going to be die with infection. And food, oh my God, there's no food at all. Everything that they have left out, the people are going to be share each other.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Pai Mong's family is in Rangoon, as is the family of his wife, Nyu Nyu Mong. She was able to get one call through to make sure her relatives were safe. And Pai was hoping for some word of his family.
While she was on the phone, I asked her to tell them call my relatives. They said they couldn't because the lines are still down.
So you still don't know, Pai, even though your wife got through, you don't know what the state of your family is?
No, not at all. I'm very, very worried. And I'm concerned for their safety. My grandparents, they are old. They are about 85, 86. And I just fear for their safety, and as well as, you know, there's a big problem of hunger right now, and also problem of drinking water. One of my friends was able to call his home, and his home is close to the river, and they have seen people go into the river and drink from the river.
That's not very clean water, is it?
Oh, it's a very dirty water. It's very dirty water.
What else was your friend able to report? What other sort of direct news do you have then?
One big disappointment, it's the soldiers, the police, they used to be everywhere in Burma, especially when protests were happening. Now they are out of sight. They are gone. And they told us that they were actually cleaning up the homes of the generals who still keep their homes in Rangoon.
And have your friends or relatives seen any evidence of any Western aid getting in? I saw some photographs of a Thailand plane that had dropped off food and water, but I don't know. Are people in Rangoon seeing?
Not at all. Right now, everybody has to fend for him or herself.
So, Pai, what are you doing now? Are you still trying to get through to Burma?
I've been calling every hour, but so far no luck. But what I can do on my end, having lived in a free democratic society, is I try to raise the awareness, letting them know of the dire situation in Burma.
But it still must be frustrating for you. I mean, I've been reading blogs and chat rooms today where people are saying, I want to help, but I don't know what to do. I can't do anything. There's no way of getting help to the people there. And that includes your family.
The main problem lies in the fact that Burma is ruled by one of the worst dictatorships in the world. They make everything difficult. Then I, for myself, since I'm a political activist, I cannot go back to Burma and help my people out. So when I started hearing all these destruction, I became angry. I became infuriated with the military government of Burma because all of these could have been prevented if the government provided sufficient warning. And this death and destruction, the military government of Burma is fully responsible, and we are holding them accountable for all the loss of lives and the loss of properties.
Pai Mong and his wife Nyu Nyu Mong live in Anaheim, California. Last night, Pai held an awareness meeting at the University of California, Irvine, and he's planning to do more to bring attention to the plight of the people in Burma. Coming up in just a minute, another one of those stories about what it's like to be yanked from the immigration line at an airport in New York. Abbas Raza figured that his Pakistani heritage likely had him in trouble with Homeland Security. But then his story took a completely unexpected turn. As Abbas puts it, it was a case of mistaken identity so convoluted he was actually being arrested, accused of being a dead guy who'd been his own attacker 10 years earlier. Yeah, I know. We'll explain it in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And this one comes with something of a warning. See, it starts out like the kind of story where the guy with the dark skin and the Middle Eastern roots is yanked from an airport immigration line in a post-9/11 world. In fact, I talked with one such person recently on the program, but this story has a twist. It involves a man called Abbas Raza. Now, Abbas is not some first-time visitor without the language skills to explain himself. He has a doctorate in philosophy from Columbia and a home in Manhattan. Here's what happened. 5 years ago, Abbas was returning from visiting his parents in Karachi. His flight had been very long, 23 hours. He hadn't managed to sleep much. So he wasn't at his best when he took his place in the long immigration line at JFK Airport in New York.
I was very hungry and very tired. And when my turn came to speak with the immigration officer, he sort of looked at my passport and asked to scan my thumb or something on a little glass thing, and then he asked me to step aside, and he closed down his station, and he said to follow him. And we walked down this little hall into another room at JFK, where another two INS agents joined the one who had greeted me. They said, you are being detained. And I said, okay, for what? And they said, I think you should know for what. And I said, I don't know.
Now, just to be clear, you've been living in New York at this point for 10
years.
Yeah,
yeah, I've
been
through in New York,
this immigration line I don't know how many times, right? So it was
right.
Familiar for you, but to be taken aside,
yes.
This was...
Right. And I have gotten a few funny questions here or there once or twice before, especially after 9/11. Of course, somebody like me traveling on a Pakistani passport... But nothing serious had ever happened. And then all of a sudden, they said I was being detained. And when I asked why, they wouldn't tell me or At that point, I thought it's best to just get a lawyer. And I said, look, I want to call a lawyer now. And they said, well, I'm sorry, sir, but you cannot do that because you haven't yet legally been admitted to the United States, and therefore you have no legal standing. You cannot demand a lawyer.
I never thought
so
of that.
So I sort of thought I might be in pretty deep doo-doo. Because I had heard a lot of stories and read a lot of stories since 9/11 about people from Pakistan being detained without charge on suspicion of terrorist activity or this or that.
Yeah, and detained for some considerable time, some of them as well.
Some of them, yes. And in fact, I had a friend who was actually a student. He had worked in New York for 4 years as an analyst and then went to the Wharton School of Business to get an MBA. And in his spring break, in his senior year, just a couple of months before graduating, he had gone to Pakistan, and coming back, he was suddenly arrested on suspicion of something or other. They never told him what it was because they're not required to under the Patriot Act. And he was held for a couple of months by the INS in some facility and, thank God, not sent to Guantanamo or something, but deported back to Pakistan. He has still not been able to finish his MBA.
You're really not sure what's going to happen
to you.
Yeah,
so at this
point
I was, you know, I had visions of Guantanamo in my head, and that's when my knees went a little trembly and I didn't feel so good. I was sort of sweating profusely and...
Which probably didn't help your case as they watched you.
yes. Well, that's the thing about people trying to make you feel guilty, that you start feeling so nervous and that confirms that to them that you have something to hide, even when you don't. and this is the really, I think this is the most terrible thing about the Patriot Act. If that didn't exist, that bit of legislation, which I think is the most retrogressive and dangerous piece of legislation that I can think of in recent history, if it weren't for that, if due process were present, as it should be always, I wouldn't have felt nervous like that because I know that there's a process. I know that I can prove whatever they are saying about me is wrong, given a chance. But what the Patriot Act, I think, does is it just takes that chance away. And that's really scary, especially to people of Arab or Muslim descent like me.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Abbas Raza says the agents handcuffed him and left him in a small room deep inside JFK Airport. Initially, he says, they refused his request to even use the telephone.
I was sitting there for some time, kind of becoming more and more nervous and thinking thoughts like, what if they put me on a plane to somewhere else, some kind of secret flight or God knows what? I'll just sort of disappear because so far there's no record of my even having landed here. I was so exhausted that I think that also had a bit to do with my paranoia. But at one point, a woman INS agent came into the room to get something she needed or something, and I sort of pleaded with her to let me just quickly call my girlfriend, who is now my wife, and let her know where I am, and so because she'll be worried about me. She expected me to be home by this time, blah, blah, blah. And this woman was nice enough to let me use her cell phone. In fact, she had to dial the number and hold the phone up to my head so I could talk into it because my hands were handcuffed behind my back.
And what would you say under circumstances like that? Honey, I'll be late. I'll tell you later.
No, my girlfriend is fairly with it, and she realizes that if I have a certain urgency in my tone, then it's some kind of an emergency. I mean, she has dealt with things like deaths in the family or other emergencies where I have called and said, look, I need you to do this and do it quickly. And she doesn't get flustered. Yeah. She just deals with what needs to be done then. And then she can sort of have the emotional collapse later. so I called her and I said, look, I need you to just listen to me. I don't have long to talk. I've been detained by the INS. I am at JFK. I am in their custody. I need you to call my brother and my lawyer and let these people know what's happening. and get them on it to find out like why they are detained, right. Because they are not telling me anything. I don't know anything else about why they're holding me or what this is about. I suspect it's some kind of mistake. And the woman who had let me make the phone call said, okay, now you've told your wife.
Abbas Raza was left alone after that. By now he'd spent 5 hours in that small room and he was starting to feel physically ill when the door opened again.
In with the INS agent walked two NYPD officers, and the INS agent said, well, they have a warrant for your arrest. So I said, okay, and that in a weird way came as a relief to me because I realized that it is obviously a mistake because there's nothing that I should be getting arrested for. And
you also, at this point, have the satisfaction of knowing that this is not some mistaken immigration matter if the New York police are there, right?
Right, exactly. And the New York police have to deal with New York courts. And if anybody innocent is accused of doing something or whatever, they can, you know, fight it in court and prove their innocence. And I felt a lot better. All those thoughts about extraordinary rendition and to strange countries and CIA flights and Guantanamo and all at least were able to vacate my head.
But what are you thinking at this point? You're thinking, what, parking tickets? What have I done?
You know, I had no idea, but I was convinced that it is a case of mistaken identity. And sure enough, immediately the NYPD officer said to me, all right, Samson, let's go. And I thought, wow, in my exhausted state of almost, I thought maybe I'm suffering from delirium. What I thought of is that old epic movie, Samson and Delilah, which I had seen in my childhood in Karachi. And I thought, well, is this a bad dream?
Yeah, could he be calling me Hercules?
Like, should I call him Delilah in return? Like, what? This is some kind of very bad nightmare. But no, I didn't wake up. The INS guys took their handcuffs off, and these guys put their handcuffs on. And they kept calling me Edward Samson, which sounded to me vaguely familiar, but I just couldn't place it.
They didn't say what the outstanding arrest for Edward Samson was at this point?
No. They did not say you are being arrested for such and such. All right. They said is they were two officers from the Queens Warrant Squad. There's a warrant out for you in Manhattan. Our job is just to take you there. Then they just sort of led me out of the airport, which was a little bit embarrassing because I hope there's no one there who I know, because I came out, everybody else came out rolling a little cart of baggage. I came out being held by each arm by an NYPD officer, and they looked very proud as if they had made a big arrest. But I was dressed very well. I had had a nice suit tailored in Pakistan, which I decided to wear on the flight only because I didn't want it rumpled in my luggage. And so I was stylishly dressed for my perp walk.
So into the car, and I guess on your way into the city, could you talk to these guys?
Yeah, there was. They had a van. They put me into the back of handcuffed, and that's when, just as soon as we were pulling out from the airport, I remembered who Edward Samson is.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. So it all came rushing back to him. Abbas Raza had this sudden memory of where he'd heard the name Edward Samson before. It took him back 10 years. He had just moved to New York to start his PhD program in philosophy. His nephew was visiting. The two had gone out to a well-known bar near the university, and his nephew had draped his jacket over a chair at an empty table while the two went up to the bar for a drink.
And some people came and sat down at that table, four men. And when my nephew realized this, he turned around and tapped one of them on the shoulder to retrieve his jacket against which this man was leaning. And I didn't see exactly what happened, but I saw that this guy suddenly got up and sort of pushed my nephew back and started yelling at him and cursing at him and repeatedly using the N-word, as we now call it. Then I suddenly saw this guy grab the back of my nephew's head or his hair with his left hand and draw his right hand back as if to throw a punch. And in that split second, I didn't even really have to make a conscious decision. I just lunged from the side and hit him first before he could throw his punch.
With your fist, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. I got him pretty good. He fell down on the ground, and with my momentum from having jumped at him or lunged at him, I fell on top of him. And we were then sort of trying to hit each other on the floor. It became a silly bar fight. Mm-hmm. When we were rolling around on the floor of this bar, we were eventually stopped, and all of us were thrown out. And now it turns out that these guys were skinheads, these four men. And they don't like dark people, and they don't like immigrants, and whatever their philosophy or ideology is, I'm not completely sure. And
but it was in their interest to continue this outside?
Yes. And over there, there were four of them. And so they managed to knock me to the ground, and I hit my head on the sidewalk and was dazed for an instant, and these guys sort of managed to really give it to me pretty good. I had a fractured eye socket, this, that, both black eyes.
How was your nephew?
My nephew managed a little better than me, because I was the one who had sort of hit the guy.
Right.
And so his anger was mainly directed at me, and my nephew, correctly realized what's the point of there's nothing to do, and tried to stay a little bit out of it. And luckily they left him, relatively speaking, alone.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Well, the fight didn't last that long, and the four skinheads were walking away, but someone had dialed 911, and the police showed up. Abbas Raza was explaining what had happened, but the officers didn't really seem that interested.
You know, the police, it's not a stabbing or a this or a that. They are a little reluctant to, a guy got roughed up and beaten up a little bit in a bar, okay, maybe they were all drunk or something. It's not such a big deal. So they're a little bit, they try to encourage you, instead of clogging up the court system and the police stations with a lot of paperwork and having to process cases like this, I think they try to say, look, why don't you just call it, just say it was a bad night, like you shouldn't have been here, like forget about, go home, come on, let those guys go home, whatever, you had a little disagreement, you'll probably never see him again, whatever. But I was completely outraged that this had happened, and I said, no, I insist that they must be arrested, because I have just been assaulted, and assaulted quite badly, and I want the perpetrators of this assault arrested.
Right.
And the police told me, okay, since they will no doubt say that you assaulted them, and in a case like this, all we can do is arrest everybody, because there is a complaint and a counter-complaint. So then realize that you and your nephew will also be arrested. And I thought to myself, look, here the police don't have time to figure out what really happened. But in a court of law, I can produce witnesses, my other friend who was there, and even the bartender or whoever else I need to, and I can show that what I'm saying is correct and what they are saying is not correct. And so I said, sure, arrest us all, because I thought, okay, yeah.
We'll sort it out later.
Yeah, we'll sort it out later, but I'm not letting these punks get away with this kind of behavior. You know,
are they still hanging around? Are the skinheads even there at this point?
They have walked away, and I'm now rushing the police and saying, look, they're walking away. You have to get them and arrest them. So the police went and arrested them.
And you, I guess.
All of us.
What was the moment that you heard the name of the person who you'd been fighting with?
Ah, Yes. We all had to fill out forms. And I kind of saw him writing his name and address because we were all seated close together. So I remember thinking, oh, he lives in the East Village. What's he doing up here on the Upper West Side? And I saw his name, Edward Sampson.
The real Edward Sampson eventually got charged with assault, but apparently that was the last time the police ever saw him. He never did appear for his court date. Abbas Raza and his nephew were released. But we have to bring this story back to the present to ask why it is, 10 years later, Abbas is being arrested and accused of being Edward Sampson. We'll do that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. A very strange sequence of events put Abbas Raza in the back of a police van on his way from JFK Airport into New York City. His fingerprint had been checked at immigration, and that had triggered an alert. Two New York City cops were sent out to the airport to pick him up, and they were insisting on calling him Edward Sampson, not Abbas Raza. It was only after hours of waiting and confusion when they were all on their way into the city when Abbas suddenly remembered where he'd heard that name, Edward Sampson, before. 10 years earlier, Abbas had been assaulted by a skinhead outside a bar in New York City. That skinhead's name was Edward Sampson.
I think it was just a little period of incubation, you know, just letting the name sort of float around in my head until it made a connection with something. I just needed a bit of time. You know how that happens sometimes. If you try too hard to remember something, you can't remember it.
Right.
But if you start thinking about something else, suddenly it comes to you.
So now I have this image of you sort of moving ahead in your seat and saying, you can stop and let me out. I know who Edward Sampson is.
It was kind of like that. I was like, yo, guys, I figured it out. This is how I think you should speak to the NYPD. Like, yo, guys, like officers.
All right.
I don't know. I'm from Pakistan, man.
So are they paying attention or are they just going, okay, here comes this guy's next excuse, you know?
You know, yeah, exactly. At this point, I've been just already, before I remembered this thing about Edward Sampson, I've repeatedly been saying, look, I'm not Edward Sampson. Do I look like I could be someone named, you know, I'm a Pakistani man. I look Pakistani.
Right.
I don't look like I could be named Edward Sampson. I said, look, this is like saying my name is Nigel Worthington III or something. This is not a name somebody who looks like me could possibly have. If you had accused me of being, let's say, Abdullah Salim or something like this, okay, maybe I would still object, but I could understand how you could make that mistake.
But the question is, Abbas, are the cops engaged on this? Are they actually having this conversation with you? Or are they like...
Yeah.
Okay.
They are. They're kind of saying things like, yeah, whatever, man. Like, you got some good excuses going. Fingerprints don't lie, my friend. Like, yeah, you don't look like someone called Edward Sampson, but fingerprints don't lie, man.
Did it turn, though? Was there a moment when the police started to listen to you?
Well, when I remembered who Edward Sampson is, and I had this sort of epiphany and this eureka moment, or whatever you want to call it, in the back of the van, and got very excited, and I was like, dudes, I've just remembered who Edward Sampson is, and I can explain how this must have happened.
Yeah.
And I told them my whole theory about there must have been a mix-up of I got arrested with this guy who had assaulted me, and we were all taken to the same precinct, and somehow they must have mixed up his fingerprints with mine. And so they were like, their first reaction was, man, you are pretty inventive. You know, you come up with one crazy story after another. And it was disbelief, but I kept repeating it. And then one of them, Detective John Reagan, started paying attention and sort of believing me. And he said, well, because I think he rightly sensed that no one could make up under pressure this craziest story. that there might be a kernel of truth in it. And then by the time we got back to the courthouse in Manhattan, by this time I had managed to convince John Reagan that what I was telling him may well be the truth. And he said to his partner, you take him into court and I will go check the arrest records from 10 years ago.
So while one of the policemen, John Reagan, went to check those old records, Abbas Raza went before the judge, where he was once again struggling to make his case. His own court-appointed lawyer was refusing to believe him even as the two faced the court.
He kept saying, look, you will have no jail time. I guarantee you I'll get you community service. Just admit it. You are who you are. Mr. Sampson, you must admit who you are. I kept saying, I'm not Mr. Stop calling me Mr. Sampson. I'm not Mr. Sampson. So I considered saying I'll just represent myself. Thank you. But I didn't even do that. Meanwhile, John Reagan found the arrest records and brought them up into the courtroom. And luckily, this file had a Polaroid picture of Edward Sampson in it, who was a blonde, skinhead, white man, aged about 19 or 20 at that time, 10 years previously. And Dick, will you believe this? My lawyer, the public defender, he looks at this and he says, that could have been you 10 years ago.
Oh, no.
Like, I said, what do you mean? You think I've changed race? in the past 10 years, I've suddenly done a kind of reverse Michael Jackson. Like, I've gone from being a dark man to
a white man to
a
dark
man. I mean, from
a
white man to a dark man. And, you know, the police officer showed this folder to the judge. And she understood and she listened to my story and believed it. At this point, the public defender was like the Energizer Bunny. He's still going on the same path. He says to the judge, Your Honor, I would like to plead blah, blah, blah for my client, Mr. Sampson. And the judge says, your client is clearly not Edward Sampson. Don't you understand? And then the judge turned to me and said, Mr. Raza, you're free to go. And not quite that, because I wasn't completely free to go. It turned out that since I had been turned over to the NYPD by the INS, they were legally required to now transport me back to JFK and turn me over to the INS, who could then, if they like, release me.
At this point, though, at least you were going back to the airport as Abbas Raza.
Yes, exactly. Although this would come back to haunt me later on other trips in and out, and it took years of all kinds of spending thousands of dollars on lawyers and people to get, you know, once you are fingerprinted, these things are sent all over. For example, they told me my fingerprints are stored in an NYPD database in New York City. They are in Albany. They are with the state police. They have also been sent to the FBI. So if there is a mistake, you must contact each of these agencies and somehow get them to correct it or deal with it. And I didn't know how to do this, so I had to hire people to do this. But Dick, here's the weird part of what happened. This Detective John Reagan of the Queens Warrant Squad really turned out to be an angelic personality. He, as they were dropping me back to JFK, to the airport, he said, look, maybe I can help you with trying to get this cleared up now that we know that you're not Edward Sampson, and give me your number or something, and I look into, you know, I'm often downtown in the courthouse, and I look up the records for this guy and see what the deal is. And because at this point, I didn't know. The man may have been arrested for other more serious crimes since, and I didn't want to be associated with him in any way.
Yeah, no kidding.
And so I very happily welcomed John Reagan's offer, and he called me a couple of weeks later with the very bizarre and somewhat sad, despite the fact that this is a man who assaulted me, but I felt saddened to hear this, that Edward Sampson had in fact killed himself in 1996 by jumping out of the fifth floor window of his apartment. And so it now turned even more bizarre, because I had been arrested as a dead man for assaulting myself.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Abbas Raza says he continued to have problems at the airport for years after this incident, something about having that asterisk beside his name. But he is now an American citizen, and that makes arriving in the U.S. a lot easier.
Last night was the first time I flew into the United States with a United States passport.
Hey, you got in the other line.
And it's a good feeling, I tell you. I wrote about this experience, Dick, in a little article in a magazine, and they have an online presence, and a lot of people left comments on it. And one thing I was disappointed to see was that a lot of people thought that this whole strange and bizarre ordeal had something to do with some kind of racial profiling or some kind of prejudice against either Muslims or Pakistanis. And I had not meant to imply that. And I want to be very clear with you that despite my fears,
right,
because of the Patriot Act and so on, it turned out that this was just a clerical mistake in a police station.
But
and
that's what makes it such a bizarre story. It begins in many ways along the lines that we expect it to begin. You know, respected
right.
scholar comes in, yanked out of INS line, disappears to Guantanamo, is never heard of again. But wait a second, it's a loopy, mistaken identity story. When you went through the INS line, did the agent say, "Welcome home," now that you can flash a U.S. passport?
Look, this is New York. Nobody's that polite. Forget about it. It's more like, "So, how long you been out of the country?" Something like this, you know. Like, no, but it's good. The guy just stamped my passport, and we don't in New York. We don't do a lot of the pleasantries thing.
Abbas Raza joined me from a studio in New York. I wonder if you've ever been confused for being someone else. Could you top his story? If you've got one, let me know. Find me at our website, thestory.org.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Earlier this week, I talked with An Duong. She was a teenager in Saigon in the latter years of the Vietnam War. She was there when the Viet Cong rockets came into her city, so she knows exactly what it's like to be under aerial bombardment. That's why I found it so interesting to learn that after her rescue by American forces and after her family settled in the U.S. and after she completed her schooling, she set her sights on work as a weapons designer. An Duong is now one of the senior science advisors to the Navy, working on those bombs that will penetrate caves where Al-Qaeda and others are reported to be hiding. Here's how An Duong explained her perspective.
You know, any weapons of war are designed to kill. So once a weapon of war is created, the intention is to kill. The question then is how we use that weapon. When should it be used? In what manner? Do we use it responsibly, or do we use it indiscriminately, like the communists did in Saigon, just to kill civilians? As a scientist, And as somebody who has strong compassion to our troops, I want to make sure that if and when the United States, our country, our president, our Congress decide that we are going into war and we're going to send our guys into a war, then I want to make sure that I help them come back alive. And in order for them to come back alive, they have to have the best weapon. Otherwise, why would you go into a war?
After An Duong spoke with me, a number of you wrote about what you'd heard. Saul wrote to say, as one who survived a communist takeover, in my case Cuba, it's impossible to convey to you how true her words rang in my ears. She brought a perspective that seldom gets heard on National Public Radio. But what I liked the most were her words on behalf of our soldiers and why she does her work. It's refreshing to hear a person speak with such clarity of purpose. Now, Patrick from Vermont wrote to say that he felt An Duong's story was really sad. Ms. Duong misses the point of what makes this country great. It is certainly not weapons. Instead of telling a story of a war refugee who was saved and had a chance to make a contribution to the world, we learned about a woman who thinks making bombs makes us free. The day our strength becomes bombs, says Patrick, is the day we become more like the old Soviet Union. Jesse wrote to say, I'm a veteran from that period, although I was never stationed in Vietnam, but An Duong's telling of why she went into weapons development touched me. I feel that she may have been born in another country, but she's a better American than many who were born here. And finally, Paul from Los Angeles wrote to say, in hearing your interview with An Duong, the scientist and engineer of America's first thermobaric bomb, I was transported back to elementary school in a conversation I had with a Vietnam refugee girl named Jill. She'd recently come to our school, and I'd found that the one thing we had in common was that we were both struggling with reading. One day I asked her how it was that she was so good at math, and she replied, numbers are universal. It's the same in Vietnam as it is in America. I don't have to learn a new language. And it was then I first started to realize that some things, like music, art, science, or laughter, are common ways we can bond as humans. I got from your interview with Ms. Duong the great strength of what brings us together. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Claudia Windahl spent her life looking for ways to serve people, first as a Catholic nun, then as an Episcopal priest, and along the way she learned she had her own Lakota Indian heritage. And her life began to change when an Ojibwe acquaintance, a woman called Verna, asked her for an unusual favor. Verna asked if she'd help transport the body of a cousin who died and take him back home.
And we went down, rented a van, went to Chicago.
Who was in the van with you?
Just the next of kin, Verna and myself. We spent the night in Chicago, picked the body up the next morning. Verna had gone through her cousin's belongings and had all of his Ojibwe singer tapes, which I said, you know, you're going to drive me nuts on this trip, being Lakota as I am. And she said, that's okay. You know, my cousin would want this music. And I said, you're the elder, that's fine. You know, it's only 8 hours. And coming back, we got to talking about how difficult it is for our people to be buried, to find respect, to get bodies back to their homeland where they might be buried. And Verna very clearly turned to me and said, okay, you know, you recognize the problem, Claudia. Now you must do something about it. And I said, oh, all right, sure.
And that was the beginning for Claudia. She got so involved with this issue of finding respectful and affordable funeral services for Native Americans, she started her own funeral home. And I'll talk with Claudia Windahl about that tomorrow on The Story. If you have an idea of a story or a suggestion of one that you'd like to talk about, you can always get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org or leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.